Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at this really incredible editorial about Opus 40 today.
Yeah, which is this monumental stone landscape up in Saugerties, New York.
Right, created by the Bard College professor, Harvey Feit. And, okay, let's unpack this, because Feit's story is just the ultimate example of a setting unexpectedly swallowing the art.
It really is.
Like, imagine spending decades meticulously carving this beautiful, elaborate wooden frame. You know, your only intention is to use it to hold a tiny, simple sketch.
Right, just a border.
Exactly. But after 25 years of carving, you step back and you realize, wait, the frame itself is the actual masterpiece.
I mean, that is exactly what happened here. And it started with a completely different goal. Back in 1938, Feit bought this spent 19th century bluestone quarry.
He wasn't trying to build a giant landscape, though.
No, not at all. He literally just bought it for the raw carving material.
Because he was a direct carving sculptor, meaning he didn't bother making clay models first. He just attacked the raw stone directly with his tools.
Exactly. But the transition from carving individual statues to organizing a 6.5-acre landscape.
Yeah.
I mean, that required a massive conceptual leap.
Yeah, I bet.
What's fascinating here is that to figure out how to handle all that leftover quarry rubble, he had to look backward, like way backward.
Oh, to the Mayan ruins, right?
Yes. In 1938, Feit was hired to restore Mayan ruins at Copan in Honduras. And that is where he learned dry stone masonry.
But wait, I have to ask, I mean, why on earth would you bring a 1,000-year-old technique back to upstate New York? Isn't it just sheer madness or, like, stubbornness to spend 37 years manually stacking waste stone without mortar?
When modern concrete exists, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like madness, sure.
Yeah.
But there's actually a brilliant structural logic to it. Dry stone masonry doesn't use mortar because it relies entirely on friction, center of mass, and locking angles.
You fit
the cut stone together so perfectly that the weight itself brines the wall. It actually breathes and shifts with the extreme frost cycles of New York.
Oh, wow. So whereas rigid mortar would just crack and fail in the winter.
Exactly. Gravity holds it together better than cement could.
Okay, that makes sense. So for 25 years, he is manually stacking the stone into terraces, ramps, and pools just to create elaborate pedestals for his carved statues.
Yep. Just a really intense backdrop.
And it all culminates in 1964 when he finds this 9-ton bluestone column in a stream bed. He wants it as the centerpiece. But, like, yeah. How does one guy lift 18,000 pounds?
Through pure mechanical ingenuity, honestly.
Like,
yeah, he hoisted it upright using a hand-built timber A-frame and a block and tackle, which is basically just a system of pulleys that mechanically multiplies your pulling force.
Wow.
But running a winch off his pickup truck through those pulleys, he used physics to do all the heavy lifting.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Once that 9-ton monolith is standing there, held purely by its own weight, Feit has this massive realization.
A total shift in perspective.
Right. He looks at this vast backdrop he built for his statues and realizes the backdrop is the actual sculpture.
The pedestal became the monument.
Exactly. So he does something incredibly brave. He walks around and actually removes his own carved figures off their pedestal.
Just moves them right to the edges of the property.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is an unbelievably rare act of ego death for an artist. He accepted that his original vision was kind of wrong.
Yeah, and by surrendering to the landscape, he accidentally vaulted himself decades ahead of art history. I mean, he started laying this stone in 1939.
Right.
That predates the famous land art movement of the 60s and 70s, like Robert Smithson moving all that earth for a spiral jetty by 3 whole decades.
Feit arrived at land art completely isolated. The critic, Brendan Gill, famously called Opus 40 a cousin of Stonehenge.
Which is such a great description.
It is. And Feit actually named it Opus 40 because he estimated it would take him exactly 40 years to finish.
Which brings us to the tragedy of it all. In 1976, during his 38th year of work, Feit died in an accidental fall while riding a mower right there on the site. He poured his entire life into this stone and ultimately became a permanent part of its history.
It's deeply poetic, but just heartbreaking. So what does this all mean? For you, listening to this right now, I think Feit's obsession forces us to look at the settings in our own lives. You know,
very definitely.
We all have supporting structures, our daily routines, a side project, maybe a garden we tend to. If you pursued them long enough, could the setting actually become your main subject? In an era completely obsessed with speed, There is something profoundly grounding about a handmade project you simply cannot accelerate.
You really can't budget a 37-year project.
Right.
And this raises an important question to leave you with. Fight's stepson noted that the work was as complete as it ever would be when Fight died in year 38.
Right, because he'd already made peace with it.
Exactly. But if Fight hadn't fallen, what would he have done with those final 2 years? Having already stripped away his own statues to honor the landscape, would he have added more to Opus 40, or would he have continued taking things away?